fine songs that were led just a few minutes ago. We're so grateful to see you here this morning. Boy, it's cold outside. I thought I was moving where there's warm weather. It's cold here as it is in Indiana. I don't understand it. Especially when people tell me last year was kind of an anomaly. I'm not sure that's necessarily the case. I want to begin this morning by reading to you and with you from a very familiar passage in the Old Testament book of Judges. I know when we think about the book of Judges, we don't think that they're familiar passages, but there really are. And that is found in chapter 2 and in verse 10. And it's very, I think, akin to maybe some of the songs that we sang this morning. It said, when all that generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord, nor the work which he had done for Israel. Verse 11 continues, then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. You know, when I read that passage, and I've shared it with you on a number of occasions, I don't see in the passage parents who decided that they were not going to instruct their children. They did not intend for their children, I'm confident, to grow up and rebel against God. That's not what those parents set out to accomplish. However, that is the result of things that were occurring among the generation who had known some of the miracles of God. They did not pass that along to their children. And I think sometimes we as parents and even as grandparents, we tend not to think about maybe some of the choices that we've made, some of the decisions that we've made, and how they may impact our children. You know, it kind of reminds me after a little boy at school, he turned in his homework. And the teacher examined that homework and said to the little boy, how can one person make so many mistakes on a paper? And the little boy responded to the teacher, one didn't. My dad helped me. And I think this is kind of characteristic of the way that it is with the raising of children. We help our children to become what they become, whether we intend for that to happen or not. You know, we're told to train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. And that training of our children is extremely important, and it is very comprehensive. It is so comprehensive sometimes that I think we fail to realize just how comprehensive it is, because it involves what we say, it involves what we do, it involves the way that we live, it involves the examples that we set. And I think that all parents today would probably be like I suggested those parents in Judges chapter 2 to be. That as we look at our children and we'll say, you know what? I didn't raise them to do what they're doing. I didn't raise her to become a rebellious young woman. I didn't raise him to get to a certain age and decide that he's not going to go to church anymore. And I certainly didn't raise my son to involve himself in marijuana or in other drugs. I did not raise him to do the things that he or she is doing. I didn't raise them that way. You know, I think sometimes we may fool ourselves. I think sometimes, while that may be true in a lot of areas, we didn't raise them to do these things. I think really what we need to realize is maybe the way that we've lived, maybe the things that we've done have in fact led them to do the things that they do, whether we intend for that to be the case or not. You remember, and all of us do, you remember what happened to David in 2 Samuel chapter 11 when he, without regard to his commitment to God and without regard to another man's wife or even another man's life, David took Bathsheba, the wife of another man, and had relations with her. She became expectant with a child. He then had her husband killed. Oh, I understand that Nathan came to him And David repented of that. But do you know that what David did had a long-term effect upon his children? You read in 2 Samuel chapter 13 how that David had a son by the name of Amnon, and he had a daughter by the name of Tamar, and Amnon and Tamar would have been half-brother and sister. Well, let me show you what happened in verse 14 of 2 Samuel chapter 13. The Bible says that Amnon forced his sister. He raped his sister. He showed the same lack of control that his father had. And then later on, we see that Absalom, again, who would have been the brother of Amnon, had Amnon killed in 2 Samuel chapter 13 and verse 28. Now, Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, "Watch now, when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, when we get him drunk," he said, "and then I say to you, strike Amnon and kill him, and do not be afraid." He did exactly what his father did. In having Amnon killed, this is the way that David had Uriah killed. So you see, what we do and the way that we live and the way that our homes are going to have a direct bearing upon our children, whether we intend for that to be the case or not. Staying in the book of Samuel, in 1 Samuel chapter 3, we read of Eli and Eli's sons. And we recognize that the Bible says that Eli's sons were very rebellious and ungodly men. Notice in 1 Samuel chapter 2 and in verse 12, "Now the sons of Eli were corrupt," that is, they were worthless men, "and did not know the Lord." Well, somebody said, well, they grow up to be, you know, men of, making their own choices. Well, this is true. They did grow up and make their own choices, but now notice what God says about Eli in chapter 3 and verse 13. He said, "Now I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile and he did not restrain them." So you see the choices that Eli made, whether he intended for the consequences to be like they were or not, they turned out that way because he did not restrain his sons. He did not control them. Now, you know, some very basics here that we need to understand is that the raising of our children, there are two absolute critical essentials in the raising of our children. Some of the essentials involve teaching or training those children in the way that they should go. Again, Proverbs 22 and verse 6, "Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it." You train a child because there is a way that child is to go, and the training puts that child on the way that he should go, and there will be some long-term benefits. When he's old, he'll not depart from it. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, God laid out very clearly what the children of Israel were to do. They were to hold his word within their heart, and they were to teach it diligently to their children. That's something that they did not accomplish according to Judges chapter 2. But they were told, this is how you are to raise your children. You shall teach them diligently, verse 7. You shall talk of them, that is, the commands of God, when you sit in your house, when you walk in the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. First thing they hear in the morning, the last thing they hear at night are the words of God. This is part of teaching and training. This happened to Timothy. In 2 Timothy 3 and verse 15, Paul says that from childhood you have known the Holy Scriptures, which were able to make you wise unto salvation, which is by faith in Christ Jesus. Fathers are commanded by God to raise their children in the teaching and in the discipline of the Lord. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. This is critical. If we're going to raise our children to know the Lord and not depart from His commandments, it's got to be involving this essential. But there's another. We must, as parents, set good examples to our children. You know, Paul speaks of the faith of Timothy's mother and his grandmother as being genuine in 2 Timothy 1 and verse 5. Believers, regardless of our age, are to be an example of the life that we live before others and before our children. Paul points this out in Titus 2 and verse 7. But I want you to notice something that is said in 1 Kings chapter 22. This is something that I believe is extremely interesting, but at the same time, it ought to cause us to have just a little bit of fear and trepidation when it comes to the raising of our children. I want to notice with you what the Bible says in 1 Kings chapter 22 and in verse 51. It said, Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel in Samaria. Now you drop down to verse 52. And it said, he did evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of his father, Ahab, and in the way of his mother, Jezebel. So I want you to notice something. How he was raised caused him or allowed him to make the choices that he made. The example that he saw, both in his father and his mother, were something that he was living out in his life. So you see, we have to recognize that while we have this little window of opportunity to raise our children, it's very comprehensive. We must teach them diligently the ways of God. But in the second place, we have to show them how this teaching of God plays out in our lives, the examples that we set. You know, I just think about it. If I don't read my Bible as a father, if my children do not see me sitting down and reading my Bible, not just to help them get their lessons, but in order for me to understand the will of God in my life, do you think they're going to grow up and read the Bible other than just getting their lessons together? If my children do not see me praying, if they do not see me on my knees petitioning God, do you think my children are going to grow up to be praying men and women? And this is just the way that it is. We've got to teach, but they've got to see that what we're teaching is lived out in our lives. Do I give as I should? Do I love my neighbor as Jesus calls upon me to do? Now, let's think about that in some particular areas here. Because very often, what happens is, like we pointed out at the very outset of this lesson, we'll look at what happens in our family, maybe with our children, maybe with our grandchildren. And fathers and mothers lament how those children have turned out. And they'll say very often, well, you know, I didn't raise them to do what they're doing. I didn't raise them to make the choices that they're making. I didn't raise them. Now, let's have some specifics here. Very often a parent will say, you know, I didn't raise them to quit attending church services when they grow up. I didn't raise them that way. Here are parents who have children that grow up, and when they reach the age of going off to college or they move across town, get an apartment, and start working, and they're no longer under the auspices or under the house rules by which they were raised, then suddenly they stop attending services. And parents are concerned about that. And they'll come to the preacher, they'll come to the elders, and they'll say, can you do something? Can you say something? I don't understand why he's quit. I don't understand why she's not going anymore. Because I didn't raise them to quit attending the services of the church. But I gotta challenge that. Am I sure that I didn't raise them to quit attending the services of the church? You say, J.R., I don't understand that. I brought them all the time. I brought them to Bible class. And we were attending most of the services. And I even talked to them about Hebrews 10 and verse 25 that says, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together is the manner of some. I raised them to believe that. And I raised them to respect that passage. But you know what? Here's what the problem is. The problem is I might raise my children to read that passage, to believe that passage, to respect that passage. But you know, at the same time, I may not emphasize what else is emphasized in the context of that passage. Let me show you what I mean. There's more to Hebrews 10 and verse 25 than just showing up to attend the services of the church, of the local church. Because you see, the context of this passage talks about togetherness. It talks about the value of being together in an assembly like this. It talks about the value of one another in the context of an assembly. You see, there's more than just coming and punching a clock and being at the services of the church. It talks about drawing near. Look at verse 22. Let us draw near with a true heart. This is what our assemblies are involved with. In the full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast. He said in verse 23, the confession of our hope without wavering. Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works. This is what togetherness involves. It's not just showing up. It's not just having our names listed on a roll somewhere and saying, yes, he or she was there. So what's the point of this? Well, as parents, do we show them? Do we show them that sometimes togetherness is not that important? Do we sometimes show them that drawing near is not really all that important? What about the time when they were in high school and there was a conflict, you know, with the homecoming game and with a gospel meeting? Or there was a conflict, you know, with some extracurricular activity at school with an activity of the church. Do suddenly we then make an allowance and let them know that in this instance, togetherness does not mean that much? That drawing near and encouraging one another doesn't mean that much? Because here you've got a conflict, so hey, it's okay under this circumstance. You know, we didn't mean for this to blossom into something that is beyond our control, but that very often happens. Do we let them know that sometimes when company comes that, you know, it's not that important to be at the 9 o'clock service, or it's not that important to be at Bible study on Wednesday night? Because this is something that, you know, took precedence. Well, we didn't mean for this to erupt into something that becomes beyond our control. But you see, when we're talking about assembling, we're talking about the value of togetherness. Together we worship God. Together we encourage one another. Together we love and provoke one another to good works. And there should be nothing that takes precedence over that value. But I think sometimes we allow our children to see us put other things before the value of togetherness, and that's something that will take hold in their hearts, whether we intend for it to occur or not. And so when we let them know that homecoming, you know, that's okay. Well, then when they get off to college, studying for a college exam takes precedence, and these other things that crop up. So, you know, sometimes when we say, well, you know, I didn't raise them to stop attending. Really? Is that something we can for sure say? Or we may say, well, you know, I didn't raise them to refuse to be active or to take an active part in the local church. Really? Am I sure that I didn't raise my children to be inactive in a local church? Am I sure that I didn't raise them to grow up to you know, not become servants, not become active teachers? Am I sure that I didn't raise them to not become elders or not become deacons or wives of elders and wives of deacons? Am I sure that I didn't raise them that way? You know, often some of the choices that we make, I think, determine what our children will grow up to become in a local church. Now, they may not stop attending. They may continue to attend, but are they active in that local church, or are they just sitters? Do they just come and sit? Well, what did they see? What did they observe? You know, just think about this. Think about what Paul says. In Romans chapter 12 and verse 10, and again, he's talking about togetherness here. He said, be kindly affectionate to one another. How, Paul? With brotherly love. Now, how does that look? In honor, giving preference to one another. And in chapter 13 and verse 7, he reminds us that we are to give honor to whom honor is due. Now, how do our children view or see our attitude and our preference and our honor when it comes to a local church? You see, it's been my observation throughout the years, ladies and gentlemen, that the view that our children will be raised with insofar as the local church is concerned, insofar as the local preachers are concerned, as far as the local elders are concerned, as far as the local teachers are concerned, is not what they've seen in the assembly. It's in what they hear on the way home, or it's what they hear sitting around the dinner table. That's where their attitudes are developed. And their view of a local church is developed outside the settings of this local assembly. If all they hear is criticism, if all they hear on the way home is the criticism of the elders, and the criticism of the preacher, and the criticism of the classes, and the criticism of the songs, and all of this, and that's all that they hear, you know what they're going to grow up? They're going to grow up to have a jaded view of a local church. And why would they want to be involved? Why would they want to become someone who is taking part when all they hear is criticism of those who are taking part? We cannot feed children a steady diet of negativism and expect them to grow up with a positive attitude about activities within a local congregation. Notice again, I want to go back to Romans 12. We read it a moment ago, be kindly affectionate to one another in brotherly love and honor, giving preference to one another. Notice what he says in verse 11. He says, not lacking in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. What do our children hear us say about VBS? What do they hear us say about worship? What do they hear us say about the Bible classes? If my children grow up and all they hear from me is criticism, then they're not going to be involved. Children ought to receive, regardless of the age, positive comments about the local church, positive comments about those who serve, positive comments about those who lead. We should be encouraging our children to take part. And this is another thing. And somebody said, how old should a child be before they learn to take part in a local worship period? I got to tell you, I think if a child is capable of writing, then that child ought to be encouraged to take notes during a sermon. I think if a child is capable of singing, that child ought to be encouraged to take part in the song service of a local church. Because we cannot let a child just simply sit there till he's 16, 17, or she's 18 years old and have absolutely no involvement in the local assembly and then expect to suddenly, you know, just like that, they're going to become active. No, this is something that takes place during the training process of those children. We can't wait until our children have no interest and then say to someone, will you help motivate my child? Because it's been a parent's responsibility to motivate their children, not only to attend services, but to take part in the services of the church. Well, let's go on. Parent may say, well, you know, I didn't raise them to become completely irresponsible in life. Really? I didn't raise them that way? Have you ever talked to anybody that it just seems like they are never responsible for anything that happens in their lives? You ever talk to anybody like that? I mean, they may have a violent temper, and they may just fly into a rage, but you know what? It's really not their fault. It's because this person has made them so angry that they can't help it. You've talked to people like that. You've talked to people who can't hold a job, but you know what? It's not their fault. It's always someone else's fault. They didn't like me. They didn't treat me well. They put too much on me. And you've heard it all before. I know I have. It's not my fault that these things happen. You know, it's always somebody else's fault. It's always the responsibility of somebody else. It goes back to Adam and Eve in the garden, and you know it as well as do I. Just the unwillingness to accept responsibility. Blame others for their indiscretions. Well, you know, I wasn't able to control myself because she did or he did. And so I'm not going to accept responsibility. Or you find people who cannot find, you know, a compatible church. Well, it's always because of this or because of that. Some people just refuse to accept the culpability for the choices that they make. Unlike the prodigal son who finally came home in Luke chapter 15 and verse 21 and said to his father, I have sinned. Too many of us, too many people perhaps I should say, are more like Judas in Matthew chapter 26 and verse 25. Do you ever notice what he said there? It's amazing to me. You know, Jesus was saying, you know, he who dips with me is one who's going to betray me. Whoever's eating with me is going to betray me. And all of the disciples begin to say, Lord, is it I? Is it I? And Judas already had set the machine in motion, says to the Lord, is it I? You know, rather than I have done this as the prodigal son, I have sinned, it's usually, is it I? What do you got on me? But how do those adults turn out that way? How is it somebody grows up to lack the ability to accept responsibility? Could it be that they were actually raised that way? Now, I don't think any of us thinks that we're going to raise a child to grow up to be totally irresponsible. But here's the thing about that. When they're young, do we defend everything they do? Do we defend everything they say against every teacher that they've had, every coach that they've had, every adult that has been in their lives? Do we defend our children no matter what, thinking that they can do no wrong? I know it's tempting. I can remember, and you're going to probably think pretty bad of me, but I remember my oldest daughter one time when she was a junior, I guess, in high school, maybe. And she decided, along with a girlfriend of hers, that they were going to skip school one day. Now, I know in the great scheme of things, that's kind of a, you know, not a big deal. Well, she rides the bus to school, and then she gets off the bus at school, and they go over to the parking lot and get in a friend's car, and off they go, and they just spend the day going to the ball and going to this, that, and the other. Didn't do anything, you know, immoral or gross or anything like that other than skipping school. Well, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I get a phone call, and it's a voice that I didn't recognize. It was a female voice, and it said, Rhonda is not at school today. And I hang the phone up and I say to Sue, I said, this person said Rhonda's not at school today. She said, well, I know she's at school. I saw her get on the school bus. I said, well, I'm going to double check this. And so I drive down to the school, which is about 5 miles away from the house, and lo and behold, she was not at school. Well, that afternoon, I go back down to the school about the time that they're supposed to be getting on the bus, and I'm kind of watching where, you know, I'm going to see if she's going to get on her bus. And you know what? She got on her bus. And she rode the bus home. Now, what do I do in a situation like that? What do you do? Here's a child that is involved in some wrong behavior, some irresponsible behavior. What do you do? Do you overlook that? Do you just simply say, okay, you made a mistake, don't do that again? What do you do in a situation like that? You know, sometimes we are overprotective. And that overprotection, I think, contributes to some irresponsible behavior in life. You know, we laugh about things that they do, thinking that it's cute and thinking that when it's really rude. We overlook things that they do because, well, it's just childish activities because it's really irresponsible behavior. I'll tell you what I did. What I did is I took her to school and we went into the principal and she confessed to the principal that, yes, she skipped school that day. And people were just appalled. You actually turned your daughter in? Yes. Because I am not going to contribute to irrational behavior. If I overlook that, what else would I overlook in life? We cannot do this. We cannot protect them from the consequences of their actions. You know, I think of the prodigal's father. One of the great things that we can say about the father of the prodigal son is he let that son, no matter how much he loved him, suffer the consequences of his behavior and didn't bail him out. And this, if we bail them out or if we expect them not to suffer the consequences of their behavior, then what we're doing is contributing to irrational or irresponsible behavior in life. Don't justify something that's wrong just because that wrong was done by a son or by a daughter. Set boundaries. Hold them accountable. Hold them responsible for the choices that they make. Because you know what? God is going to hold them responsible. And society will hold them responsible as well. And finally, we say, well, you know, I didn't raise them to believe that divorce is acceptable. I didn't raise them that way. I taught them that marriage is for life and that one man and one woman committed to each other for one lifetime is what God has authorized in His Word. I taught them that. I didn't raise them to believe that divorce is acceptable. Now, maybe I need to rethink that. You know, the Bible tells us in Ephesians chapter 5 that a man is to love his wife as Christ loved the church. A man is to love his wife as his own body. He nourishes and cherishes his wife, just as he nourishes and he cherishes his own body. And the Bible tells us in Titus chapter 2 and verse 4 that a woman is to love her husband. And I believe that is in direct response to a husband's love for his wife. And you know what? Children need to be raised in a home where Husbands are loving their wives where they can see their father loves their mother. And they need to be raised in a home where they can see that their mother loves the father in return. This is what they need to see. This is how they need to be raised. The best thing that you can give to your children is the example of what it means to be a husband or a wife in that relationship. Yes, marriage is to last a lifetime. There's no question about it. And we need to teach that to our children. But what are we showing them? What do they see at home? What do they experience at home? Is it constant fighting? Is it constant bickering? Is it blow-ups? Is it hateful words? Is it tears and just all kinds of things that are going on in that home that creates an atmosphere that is unbearable? If that's what they're being raised to see and to know, they're going to say, you know what? I'm not going to put up with that. I'm not going to live that way. I'm not going to live with the unhappiness that my mother lived with. And I'm not going to live with the unhappiness that my father lived with. I'm just simply not going to do it. Boys are looking at their fathers and how to treat a woman, and girls are looking at their mothers on how to respond to husbands. And when they see sad and unhappy moms and dads, they vow that, you know what, I'll never put up with that. I don't care what the Bible says. I'll never put up with that. And far too many children are raised in a home that reflects the home that the singer sang about, give us a happy home. And in the songwriter records about a little boy. He's been wounded already in the struggle of life, battered by raging storm of strife, caught in a whirlwind of heartbreak and pain, and blinded by its driving rain. Another stanza says, so he whispers his prayer every evening as he kneels by his bedside alone. Put mommy and daddy together again and give us a happy. If I'm not giving my children that kind of home that Todd was singing about a little earlier, where there's love in the home, and what, no matter what I say about the permanency of marriage, I'm raising my children to believe that possibly divorce will be a viable alternative. Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, 1 Kings 15 and verse 26, did evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the ways of his father and in his sin. That's the way he was raised. This study was designed to be preventative, because what we need to realize, you know, we often hear like father, like son. That's not necessarily a biblical concept in that, in so many words. It is, but not in that way. But the Bible does say in Ezekiel 16 and verse 44, like mother, like daughter. So let's be careful about the way that we're bending that little twig that God has given us, because the way that that twig is bent, Alexander Pope says, the tree will be inclined. Will you join me in prayer, please, before we go to class?